Live from the Southern Air Temple, this is Derailed Trains of Thought. Tim, this is a kind of nice, sunny,
It's breezy. Back to be back on Earth, to be honest, after all those last few episodes in space.
Is this Earth?
Well, I'm not sure. There's some weird-looking animals around here. Like, everything seems to be a mixture of two different animals. It's like we're in, I don't know, Chimeraland or something.
I know. I mean, it's very nice with the mountain. You know, we're just really high up. Mm-hmm. A nice, cool breeze.
High
clouds
altitude.
Everywhere. Yeah. This nice ruined temple.
Yeah. I wonder how old it is. It looks like it's been deserted for at least 100 years.
But I like places we can explore and not feel an overwhelming sense of, like, ominous, like, something's going to happen.
Yeah, we're not closed in for a change.
Yeah, exactly. So this is good. This is good.
Especially for the beginning of summer. You know, that's always, it's nice to be outdoors and enjoy the nice weather.
Yeah, exactly. So we're ready to tackle yet another story school.
Yay, we could just do school outside today.
Yes. This is very nice. We'll just sit in the sun and talk about a common
story idea.
Yes, trope even.
Trope, which is appropriate since that's what we did last time.
Yes, so we're going to tackle The Chosen One.
The Chosen
One. And things related.
Like fate and destiny and all that.
Destiny prophecies
kind of
and, yeah.
So what do you think, Nick? Is this a story trend you enjoy, or do you think this is one that kind of gets overdone?
Both.
A little bit of both.
Well, because here's the thing. When done well, it's a nice thing. It's enjoyable, but it is done a lot.
It is done a lot.
And sometimes it's done in a very perfunctory way, where it's just like, I'm the savior. I should save stuff.
Well, Once Upon a Time tries to do it sometimes. Sometimes they just kind of ignore it until it becomes like convenient.
Season one, they do it good, and then the aftermath of Chosen One. But anyways, okay, let's define the Chosen One first before we start. Mm-hmm. In the narrowest sense, it's basically a person who is destined to rescue, save, liberate, stop something.
Usually through some sort of prophecy, I imagine.
Like people knew they were coming, or they were only one of a kind, or yeah.
Yeah. Well, either it's through a prophecy or it's the inheritance thing. Like you're the only son of this deceased king, so it must be you.
So you are the phantom now.
Yeah.
And I think it's different, you know, because you can then, you know, there's a lot of times where you have a protagonist who has just the right skills and then he becomes kind of the only one who can do things. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe for the sake of this discussion, we won't include that. I mean, they almost like become the chosen one just because of circumstances. Do we want to include that?
Well, what by do you mean they just have the only ones who have the skills? You mean like MacGyver or?
Well, like, I know they have a special knowledge or they were born with some special, or they're just in the right place at the right time. And then they become.
Oh, and so then everyone's like, aha, you've met these certain criteria. So that must mean it's you.
Or like say Sheridan in Babylon 5, you know, he kind of becomes a chosen one, but he wasn't like prophesied or anything like that. But
that's
he just
true.
Is in the right place, right time, right characteristics. He becomes a leader. He becomes the protagonist, basically.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't think for purposes of our discussion, I don't think we have to limit it to just the prophecy type stuff because the core ideas of being chosen or being the one, you know, destiny is kind of a fickle thing.
Yeah.
But some of those same ideas can come about or can be recognized through a variety of ways. But first off, maybe it'll be helpful to list off some of the most famous chosen people.
Good idea.
Yeah, Anakin Skywalker.
You were the chosen one.
In some ways, Luke kind of follows his footsteps in that sense. You know, he becomes the new hope.
Except he wasn't really prophesied or anything. He's almost your second version. Like, he just inherits the position.
Yeah. It's like Obi-Wan and Yoda kind of depend on him because they're like, we need another Skywalker to take out. We need another.
And we don't care about Leia for some reason. So.
Well, you know, just sexism.
Yeah. So. We have Aang from Last Airbender, who he wakes up and he's like, oh, I'm the last one. I should do.
Well, and not only is he the last Airbender, so he kind of falls to him in that way, but the Avatar is kind of this title that's passed on through reincarnation.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's a very Eastern kind of show, so mythology.
Yeah. Lego movie?
Lego movie.
I don't know if that counts, actually, but it's more of a deconstruction of...
You're the special. I'm the special.
We're all the special. Wheel of Time very much has this, the dragon reborn, you know, the dragon exists 1,000 years ago, someone's going to be reborn as this person who will break the world and save it.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking your word on that.
Yeah. And it plays a lot with the, how do I even, if I have to deal with being the savior of the world, how do I deal with the pressure that comes with?
Mm. Which Last Airbender kind of goes into some of that too. Like, yeah. I remember someone pointing out that, there's the episode where they do a flashback about how Aang finds out that he is the Avatar.
Okay.
And his closest mentor doesn't want to tell him yet because he thinks it's too soon. He's too young to handle all the pressure. And Aether's like, no, there's crisis going on. He needs to know about this now and all that sort of thing. And so it does put a lot of pressure on a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see him play with that. But in contrast, I remember watching Nostalgia Critic, an online reviewer, talk about The Secret of Nim 2.
Okay.
Which, they made like a direct-to-video sequel for
I've heard of it, but I'm not watching it.
But I guess that there's one where it's the son of Mrs. Frisbee or whatever, okay. And they do a whole Chosen One thing with him, and it just kind of swells him up, and he doesn't really accomplish all that much by the end of the movie, apparently. So it's like that, you know, that's kind of a classic example of the wrong way to do a Chosen One. And you asked something about this on Twitter right before we recorded, right?
Yes, a favorite, there's people's best or worst examples of The Chosen One. And I got, my brother responded, because I don't have a lot of Twitter followers that pay attention. he says his favorite version of The Chosen One is Harry Potter.
Okay.
He's a very big Harry Potter fan. And they play that, very interestingly, because The Chosen One often, in that case, is very similar to the Dark Lord, the evil person. Mm. There's all that those similarities, and that happens a lot. And then his worst is Battlestar Galactica,
which I didn't even know there was a Chosen One.
When he first said that, I'm like, what? But there is this, what's his name? Baltar? Is that right? I'm missing a syllable somewhere, I think. But he has this vision all the time from the lady in red. I don't know if you've ever seen in the previews. Mm. Here's what you should do, and he's led, and all this other stuff. There's this prophecy of. Yeah, there is some of that, and it's very unsatisfying, just sort of like hand-waving by the end.
Oh, okay.
And then our friend Keith said, he didn't have favor worse, but he did say that there's a book, apparently, I should have brought my iPad down, but it has the name, about the neighbor to the Chosen One, basically. People who just live next to him, and uh-huh. I'll have to go find the title before at our music break.
And it is a very divisive trope, I think, a lot of times, because you get some people, and I've heard this debate regarding, what's her name, from Force Awakens.
Oh, Rey.
Rey, yes. I wanted to call her Ren or something. That's not right.
Rey Ayunami.
Rey, yeah, because some people, my perspective, it seems pretty obvious to me that she's... has Skywalker blood in her somehow. But I've seen some people online who really don't want that to be the case, that they're kind of tired of this inheritance thing, or that, would rather just have it be some random person who's also really strong in the Force.
Yeah.
And I sort of get this, there's not very many of us are given this grand destiny, at least in terms of savior complex.
Yeah. Almost people want to more, anyone could be the Chosen One. I mean, like a movie. Yeah. I think one reason people like the Chosen One idea is that many times when it's done well, it's just a normal person who suddenly gets thrown into a world way bigger than they are, and they grow into a great thing. And I think the idea was anyone could become, it's just the everyman who happens to be given this thing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed, that's why they don't want Rey to have it, because now it's become so now they're special. But I don't think that was how it was originally conceived. It's just you're going around, you live in your little village, and then suddenly it's drama. It's like, what? I'm actually a princess? Or not me, but what? My father was revelations. It's like we're reading about these people who live lives, simple like ours, and then suddenly they were brought into this whole conflict of things. And I think when done well, it just it tries to pull that, hey, we start where everyone person is and mm-hmm. then bring you into this larger world, as opposed to just being stories about great knights and stuff that we don't have any
sure
connection with.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, because like, so the idea is kind of the same. Like, it's still the common person you can identify with. It's just now it's not only that you're just a common person, it's like you're a special common person. I mean, at least that's the original intent.
Yeah, and you know, as the reader, you're identifying with their protagonist. So it's like you're coming along with this person who's entering this new world. And, you know, it's a way of, it's a nice sort of hero's journey sort of deal. I mean, that's what the Chosen One, the heroes. Now, again, you can overplay the prophecy or overplay the, you know, you're so super special, no one else can do it. And then the problem with that sometimes is that they just have special things, but there's no good reason.
Right.
You know, it just seems arbitrary. You're a special one, therefore you can do cool things, but it doesn't play into your character. It doesn't play into your, you know.
It just is. Yeah. Or I guess that's where the term Gary Sue or Mary Sue comes from, where you just have this super awesome protagonist that is awesome because the author likes this character or is trying to self put their own person inside their own story or whatever.
Like, I think that was a satisfying thing, or when I understand, like, the first Matrix movie, Chosen One. Neo, you're the Chosen One. You can do all this stuff, and it's this just this grunt. And But it gets lost somewhere. Again, I don't know if I've even seen the third Matrix movie, but then you're just like, wait, you know.
they build in all kinds of, I don't remember if it's just the Chosen One being a problem. I just remember there being
too much.
Lots of information, and it gets very complicated, and you kind of lose story progress at some point in the sequels, if I remember right. You know, and it's interesting, you know, from a real world perspective, at least from a Christian worldview, you know, we do believe that God calls people to do certain things.
Yeah.
I think God gives us a lot of flexibility in where we live our lives, but, you know, free will, obviously. Yeah. But I also think that we're kind of created to do a role.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that kind of fits in well with, again, going with like Chosen One, like the set apart person, that may be kind of overdone. I mean, in the best sense of it, it's trying to imitate a Messiah type figure.
King Arthur.
Yeah.
I mean, he just some guy, and then he goes and pulls a sword out of stone, and then he becomes, you know, he leads a country. You know, it's kind of David.
Yeah.
You know, basically from the Bible. You know, I'm just a shepherd. I just do my thing. You're anointed. Oh, you're the chosen one now. And then, but the interesting part's always is how do you act out being chosen?
Yes.
And I think that's what's interesting about the Chosen One. It's not so much that. I think the problem with the Chosen One, another problem is that it becomes shorthand sometimes where they get to do cool stuff. And they, you know, you have their train montage and suddenly you do crazy action scenes, whatever. But the best thing, you know, the best version is like, well, what do you do with being chosen? Do you live up to it? Do you serve people right? Or do you just take it to your head? You know, one of the good things I think you could say about Anakin is that is an examination of, okay, you're the Chosen One, but that doesn't mean you're going to win.
Yeah.
Apparently, I'm in the middle of this Mistborn, the first Mistborn book, and I haven't, there's going to be revelation stuff I don't understand, but the selling point on the front of the book is, what if the Dark One won?
Oh.
And again, if you read it, I'm not very far, but right now it's the whole, everything's oppressed, and you keep having snippets of like this person who was supposed to be the hero of the ages, whatever, and I think he just went bad. Or he failed or something.
Oh, interesting.
Then you live in that world now. Again, that's guesses. But the whole concept of this is that basically the Chosen One didn't work out right.
Now, that's an interesting concept. I mean, the concept by itself is not a problem if you're doing interesting things with it, if it's in service to your story. But I think a lot of ways that authors kind of fall into this hole of doing, if not just Chosen One, but the whole prophecies and fate and all this kind of stuff. I think it sort of can be a pitfall for writers because we have the whole story in our heads. You kind of know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's very easy, I think, to give it kind of a veneer of epicness by throwing in these prophecies and saying all this stuff when, I mean, if that's what your story is about, if you're very purposely going for, you know, that feel, that genre of, you know, Tolkien talked a lot about like, not fate so much, but, you know, being part of something bigger.
Basically.
Yeah, providence. Yeah, you know, like Bilbo, you didn't really think that all the stories and songs came true just because of you, did you? you know, and if that's part of your theme, cool. But if you're just using those ideas as like kind of a quick, cool old timey factor, then you're gonna have problems.
And now I don't have to make a story because he's a chosen, so I don't have to explain, you know. And prophecy is often done badly.
Yeah.
Prophecy is often done almost just to add weight to a character, even though you don't care about the prophecy, and it just is sort of like a whatever.
I mean, if you're going to go to the trouble to have prophecies and all this stuff, you better make sure that your general story is pretty big in scope.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just going to be, oh, and we saved the status quo. Then we maintain the status quo. And it's like, no, you better have some earth-shattering stuff if you're going to have prophecies get this sometime, going on.
You get this sometimes from, like, your sort of B-level, like, action adventure films. Like, I can't remember if there's actually a prophecy, but, you know, things like Prince of Persia, you know, those were a feel of movies where, like, you're important, you're the chosen one, you're the one who can help us, and then it's just sort of a normal, you know, Zorro sort of movie.
Right. And you're like...
And, like, they didn't do anything really, they just sort of were there.
Yeah. They survived.
They survived, yeah.
So, yeah, that's definitely on the bad end of how to do these things. All right, so would you consider Obed, your character from
the Unremarkable
Squire, yes, would you consider him to be a chosen one?
He is, by our definition, a chosen one. Mm-hmm. Again, he's a little bit Bilbo-ish in the sense that he didn't really... And I think I enjoy that in the fact that, okay, you fulfill prophecies, but it's not because you've been told you must fulfill this prophecy constantly or because everyone's expecting of you, just because... You're just doing what you're doing, and then suddenly, oh, wait, you're that guy we've been waiting for.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
You just kind of fell into it because you were doing the right thing.
Because you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You know, where prophecy becomes more of a, it says what's supposed to happen, but it's not. It doesn't become the instigator of what happens.
Mm. Yes.
And again, you can have that interesting when people have, like, here's what I'm supposed to do. How do I fulfill it? You know, Wheel of Time has some of that. Like, I know I'm supposed to do this. And so he tries to get done, and then things fall together. And there's almost a force of, well, in Wheel of Time, there is this thing called Taveren, where there is this force that events just change around you without you doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that can be interesting as well.
Well, isn't there some Greek myth about a king who tried to change fate by, like, it was prophesied that his son would...
Oedipus.
Oedipus, yeah. He'd take his place, and then so he sent his son away, and then
They thought he'd left him to die, but people picked him up, and then he grew up, and then he came and killed the king on the road, and then he became king and married the queen, who was his mother, and Oedipus complex then, but...
I mean, and that kind of stuff is cool.
That is cool. It's very much, you know, that wrestling with... Can you escape fate?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was one of the big plots, you know, and we talked about last time, you know, one of those
man versus fate, man versus God.
I mean, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. did that one episode where basically the...
Oh, yeah, the future thing.
Yeah, where the guy would touch you and show you basically a death, not always your death.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they're like, can you get out of that? No. You know, that was their answer scientifically.
Yeah, which is really interesting because a lot of times we think in terms of like glimpses of the future in fiction. We go back to like, say, A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
It was like, these are just shadows of what may be. But in this case, it was like, no, this is actually the future.
The future. Yeah, you can't change it because it's... And what's so fascinating about those things, and we're a little off track from Chosen One, is that when you do the future, like do future prophecy, things like that, where you can't get out of it, it's going to happen one way or another, then what's interesting is seeing the intersection of the character's free choices and what you know is going to come up, which sometimes comes off really cheesy, but you're like, no, this is going to happen. And But when done well,
right,
it can be really fascinating stuff and is a visual representation that everyone understands of this conflict we tend to have, like in religion circles, about predestination and free will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it happens effortlessly in Oedipus Rex.
Yeah.
You know, you can see both sides of the coin right there, and no one's being forced, no one, you know.
Yeah. And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. did it really well, too, because they were questioning, it was like, can we actually change this? Is there any way to do it? And it's like, well, we're going to try anyway.
And then just bring Lost in, you know, whatever happened.
Yeah.
You know, you could do a whole season of it where, you know, hey, I'm Faraday's mom, but I got to kill my son because I know I got to kill my son.
Yeah.
No. And then that's always an interesting story, too, science fiction. They do sometimes where if you know it's supposed to happen, you make it happen. Not because you want to, but because you feel like... You know, the Doctor Who thing, it's like Father's Day. You can't change time.
Yeah.
So you just kind of do it because you feel like you have to or things will break down. And that's way off track. That's the fate, you know.
Yeah. The playing with that sort of stuff,
yeah.
Which is interesting. But going back to the prophecy thing, something what you said earlier about how it tends to work best if you fulfill a prophecy, not by purposely doing it, but by just kind of doing what you would do and then... Oh, look what happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's Sword in the Stone.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in the versions I know.
Well, and it strikes me as very true, again, to biblical accounts of prophecy.
Yeah.
A lot of times, I mean, if you look at a lot of Old Testament prophecies, you would have no way to guess how they would come about until, like, in the New Testament, and the writer's like, and this fulfilled this prophecy, and you're like, oh. You know, prophecies don't really make a whole lot of sense in the moment. It's only, like, after the fact you realize, that's what it was talking about.
You know what's interesting with the biblical example is that sometimes Jesus goes out of his way to purposely fulfill a prophecy.
That's true.
He's like, hey, you need to go get this donkey because I need to go into town like that. Which is interesting.
That's a good point, just kind of saying
that's weird sometimes, but
I guess that's true. Even God's like, I need to fulfill my own promises. I mean, in that sense, it's like a fulfilling promise. Yes, this is what I'm going to do.
Or you have, like, you know, the Pilate thing was like, you know, I could let you go. He's like, no, things are going to happen like they're going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, you have no power about what, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the chosen one, and then especially the how it works with fate and prophecy, you can explore really interesting issues about that touch on, you know, big questions.
Like our purpose in life, about the nature of free will.
Mm-hmm. About, you know, are you actually special or, you know, is this just, you know, your role?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are why people love one of the main reasons people love these sort of chosen stories. And they stop liking when they stop touching these big questions, when they just become fill in the blanks.
Yeah, or like flavoring. Like they don't work well as flavoring.
They really don't. It really has to be kind of central to your character, to your story, or at least a central component.
Yes. Like it's there has to be some big ideas behind him.
Now, you read Aragorn. Not Aragorn, Aragon. Aragorn is a different thing.
Aragorn is a completely different person.
Yeah. Does that have a prophecy thing in it? I feel like when I watched the movie, it had.
See, I was trying to remember. It's been a long time since I read Aragorn. And the main things that stuck in my mind about Aragorn were the insane amounts of, like, attention to detail about the whole magic system. And about just descriptions I didn't really care much about. So I think there is some of that. I do believe he's one of the last dragon riders, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
But as you could tell, the book did not leave a lasting impression on me. It's a long book from a 15-year-old, as I've heard some people describe it, and it kind of shows.
Yeah.
I mean, remarkable that a 15-year-old could crank that out. Don't get me wrong. But
it has signs of
that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any big chosen one sort of story I've not looked at.
That we've missed. I'm glad you brought up Matrix. I hadn't thought of that when we were preparing for this.
Yeah.
I guess in a sense you could look at, in Narnia, you've got the sons of Adam, daughters of Eve.
True, that's whole.
They're all kind of called to be the guardians of Narnia.
And what's kind of interesting about that one is that they come in kind of just haphazardly and fulfill stuff. But there's also the sense that once the prophecy said that, oh, we need to get over here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something with a stone table, there's something with Caravan Parabel.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really, can be really fascinating too when there's this kind of mystery around the, like, the prophecy itself changes what the characters do.
Hmm. There is an aspect of that, yeah.
To a certain extent.
Well, and I keep going back to the biblical allusions because I find it interesting. But a lot of people had completely different ideas about who Jesus was because of their interpretations of prophecies.
Yeah.
About what the Messiah would do and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, there is another interesting avenue you could go with in terms of prophecies and that kind of stuff. Like a misunderstanding of what, well, I guess we kind of touched on that, but people think it's going to be this and it turned out to actually be this.
Yeah. And that biblical prophecy reminds me, I'm in 1 Samuel right now, is that you have an example there of both a chosen one with Saul that basically
doesn't work. Yeah, that's
that
true.
He's like, here you go. And then it just falls apart to pieces. I mean, the whole, all of Israel is a chosen one that basically breaks down constantly, but keeps, because of God, keeps going.
Keeps trudging along. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of interesting variations, even just in biblical literature that I'm sure have been played with in fiction.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, when we started this, I hadn't really realized that we would be talking about the biblical connotations, but I guess that is where a lot of it comes from.
Between from religious connotation. I mean, obviously from us biblical, but I mean, Greek has all kinds of the fates, you know.
Right.
And can you defy the fates or not? And that sort of stuff. I mean, because the Greeks have this much more impersonal sense of fate. It's just kind of this wall.
Yeah.
You know, and you're coming against it.
Yep.
And I guess maybe that's another thing with bad version of the chosen one basically is also added as a veneer of religion, a veneer of spirituality, of otherworldliness.
And it's very easy to see past that veneer, if it's done wrong. But.
And I think that's, you know, like with wants, you know, the whole savior thing, at some point just wears thin, but you're like, what does it still mean? You know, you already did your thing. You're not really more special than anyone at this point.
Yeah. You don't need to keep pulling out the savior card. You did your savior thing way back in, you know, season one. Yeah.
So.
But, okay.
That's a pretty good kind of roundup of various things of Chosen One, Prophecy, Fate, etc. I guess like everything we say here, there's good ways to do it. I mean, most of the things that people get sick of is not because it's bad. It's because it's been done too often, too mediocrely.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be harder to do it well because we have so many stories now.
That's true. It is interesting when you think about like just the backlog of pop culture, all these stories that kind of influence the stories that come out now. There's a lot you can't get away with that you used to be able to get away with.
And just because people are so, they know the structure so well.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, though, then some people, they always gravitate, I love these sorts of stories.
Yeah.
It just hits them because...
Yeah, that's true. That's true, too.
You know, really, you know, I think we've been including that chosen ones need to be vital to your story and or character.
Mm-hmm.
And seem to work best when they actually touch on some big theme, whether it's the common person finding a role or whether it's fate interacting with, you know, how, you know,
predestination,
that sort of stuff, or, mm-hmm. you know, the weight of dealing with it, you know, those sort of consequences of being chosen one
very interesting.
Yeah. Or even just, you know, if we can identify with chosen one, so we can be in our own lives, be brought outside of mundane life. I mean, I think that was probably much of the original reason it happened.
I concur.
That is our wrap-up of The Chosen One, and we will now go to our first soundtrack.
Okay, I'm going to go with soundtrack first. My reasons for choosing this remix today are twofold. One, this is from Chrono Cross, which Nick will be talking about in our next section.
I'll be attempting to talk about coherently.
So that's the name of the game that it's from. The remixer is the Pancake Chef,
which is a wonderful name.
Wonderful name. He hasn't been around. I checked.
No, that's a lot of old stuff.
This is a very old one. And the second reason I picked it is because this song actually. Listening to the song like way back in 2003, I think, is what first gave me the germ of an idea for a yet-to-be-written story called Darien's story.
Oh, nice.
Yes, it's inspired from this song, actually. It's very somber and kind of... Darien is not... I wouldn't call him necessarily a chosen one, but he's... He has sort of an Esther-like role, I would say, where, you know, he's kind of put in a...
He's certain, forced into a chosen one.
Yes, sort of. Put in such a position for such a time as this, as they say in Esther. So, yeah, this is, like I said, I've listened to this song for years.
So, nice.
I'm glad to share it with you. This is Dubbing the Body. Thank you. All right, we're back.
All right, I like that song. That was good. I can see how you get a story out of that.
Yeah, yeah, it's very peaceful.
You just had the right one.
Moody. Yes, I know. Someone reminded me of it not too long ago. I was like, oh, man, I mentioned it on the podcast like ages ago.
It's now in stone forever. Just
it,
like
it must be written.
Finishing Stern Fred someday.
It was long foretold that this story would be written.
We'll see who finishes first, Tim.
Well, you are making progress on Stern Fred, though, right?
I am making very slow progress, but if I can get in rhythm at this point in my life, it's just complicated. But if I can get a rhythm, I'm almost to where I think it'll start moving quicker and quicker towards the end.
Cool.
Close. But anyways, all right, we'll go on with our take
on Tales.
All right, so today we decided we've all played, everybody. No, Tim and I have played some video games lately, old school ones.
Yeah, yes.
And so we're going to just kind of go back and forth on
this
these.
Is special gaming edition.
Yes. And Tim requested that I do my little rant. So,
yes, we'll get to that.
Yeah, so, anyways, Tim, why don't you start?
Okay, so, you know, if you're not into video gaming, just kind of, you know, you might be interested in some of these, at least the stories anyway, and you'll get an idea of at least Japanese role playing games.
Yeah. And there's the reason I play role playing games, at least, is the stories are good.
Are fun.
Are fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. So, a while back, Nick lent me his Super Nintendo so I could finally play Chrono Trigger.
Which is one of the most famous of the Super Nintendo era
role-playing games. Yes. Yeah. And we've played the music, remixes from it on here, the show.
Numerous times.
Numerous times.
Really,
yes.
It's awesome.
Because it is, dare I say, legendary, the soundtrack. And so, I won't say too much, a whole lot about Chrono Trigger. If you don't know the story, basically, you are a silent protagonist named Chrono. He gets up one morning, his mom shoos him out the door to the carnival. He meets a princess in disguise, as you do. But then suddenly, he and another friend of his, the three of them, they find a hole in time, and they go time traveling. And in the process, through their various misadventures, they find out that in the future, namely the future of 1999 AD of that world,
yeah.
There's a monster that destroys the world. So from that point on, your goal is to prevent the monster from destroying the world, the monster being named Labos. So this game, I enjoyed it a lot. It was fun. It has a simple story. It has a very colorful, you know, SNES-style atmosphere and stuff. It still took me about 3 years to finish, I realized in the end. It's a game I really wish that I had played way back, like when I was in college or finishing college, and I was still kind of exploring role-playing games for the first time. And I feel like, one, at that point, I would have had a lot more time on my hands to, you know, go through it. And two, I feel like at that time, it would have still felt very fresh and new. Whereas me of today, like, I enjoyed the game a lot, but at the same time, it didn't really, like, wow me, like, say, Final Fantasy VI or some of the games that I was playing then where it was just like, oh, this is really cool. You could do this in a video game and a Super Nintendo thing. And because, I mean, Chrono Trigger, it's a fun, sprawling adventure, but it doesn't really go that deep. And, like, you don't have characters that, like, attempt suicide.
Like in 6, yeah.
Like in 6.
The whole world doesn't, like, explode or...
Yeah, and not that, like, deep game, meaningful games have to have these dark themes in it. And I'm not saying that. But Chrono Trigger is just, for the most part, it's a pretty lighthearted romp.
Yeah. It's, you know, you're traveling through time. You know, it's like Back to the Future in Japanese anime.
Essentially, yeah. With these little pixelated characters.
Yeah.
I definitely enjoyed it. I probably still do have a greater fondness for it than, say, Final Fantasy XII, which was just kind of there. Yeah. I mean, it has some neat ideas, but I spent a lot more time. There was a lot more game content, and the color or the characters were not quite as memorable as all the characters even in Chrono Trigger are.
Yeah, it's just a very vibrant game in many ways. Very unique. Every time period is very different.
Yep. So I was probably hyped, a little overhyped about it going into it. But if you know, kind of get a feeling for what you expect, I think you can have a lot of fun. And I imagine if you play with your kids, Nick, you'll have a good time exploring it with them.
Because I've been playing various games with my kids. Like last year, I played Super Mario 64, which was awesome.
Fun.
And it's just a lot more fun to play with the kids. They just love it, and they tell you to do things. And so
I find it great because, like, there's a certain age where you don't want to watch someone else playing video games. You want to play them.
Yeah.
But you've got kids that are at the right age that they enjoy just watching you do it. So that's cool.
And Phil would play occasionally on some of these things, but it's more fun to see me do cool things and stuff he can hardly get done. But like, so we started playing Chrono Cross. I bought Chrono Cross when it came out.
Now, this is the sequel.
This is a sequel to Chrono Trigger. Yes. I bought it when it came out, but I love Chrono Trigger. I could never get past about 6 to 10 hours.
Because you lost interest or it was too difficult?
Kind of both. It's very different than Chrono Trigger in its play style.
Okay.
I mean,
you said this is a PlayStation game, right?
PlayStation game. I mean, it's still very colorful, but it when you first start, it seems like there's nothing except for some random names of in relation to Chrono Trigger. You have magic that's very different, fighting style is different.
Is it a turn-based system like Chrono Trigger?
Yeah, except you actually go into when you monsters walk around like they do in Chrono Trigger, but then you go into a Final Fantasy type screen to fight, as opposed to just starting it like in Chrono Trigger.
That's one thing probably you couldn't do as well on PlayStation as opposed to Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But part of it was the weight of trying to talk to everyone, and then there's so many characters, so much, and it didn't take. I kept meaning to. I'm like, it's supposed to be a good game, etc. So then my kids are there, and they won't let me talk to anyone. They're like, go and fight, or go to the next thing. Which was actually really helpful in getting me over the hump in this game.
Uh-huh.
So all my thoughts after this, I have to take with a disclaimer that I really didn't read much extra dialogue besides what's you need to. I didn't talk to many people in towns and do side quests. I mean, there was this giant quest about getting the Massive Moon that I didn't even know existed because we were just always racing the next thing because
your kids were forcing you to.
Which was kind of fun. I hadn't recently played a role-playing game where I had the freedom to do that. I'm kind of a completist when I play by myself. I would talk to everyone and look in all the corners and click, make sure I can't do that.
Right.
So anyways.
Now, I want to preface this real quick in that Nick went on this big rant the other day about this, trying to explain the game. And me, as a long-term Kingdom Hearts fan, this was immensely entertaining because of just the levels of complexity the game threw at him, and he was trying to figure
out. So I guess I'll start at the end. Okay, here's my...
Spoilers!
So there's a lot of things good about the game. But plot-wise, it was very disappointing in some ways. And I think, you get to the last boss, which is Lavos again, even though your main characters don't know who Lavos is. It intersects very highly with Chrono Trigger, except none of your characters know any of these people, except, I guess Kid does kind of. But anyways, and you're at the beach right before you go to the last boss, and there's Chrono and the Princess and Luca from Chrono Trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically info-dump you. Right before you go and talk, as if they basically say, "Hey, all those questions you might have about the plot, here's some answers." And the thing is, that wasn't the first time it happened in the game. Repeatedly throughout the game, you get to a point, and then info dump about things that happened off screen. Like all the coolest stuff in the game happened when you weren't there. Okay. And then,
if that had been on purpose, there might be something interesting to that.
Yeah, and the thing is, the plot's very interesting, but you only got like the very tip of the plot, which I guess is the point. My guess is the point is, you come into this and you're doing the last 10% of this giant story, and then you complete the story because the story goes. I don't know if I can remember a little bit like this. Okay, so Lavos is destroyed in Chrono Trigger.
Spoiler, but yes.
Yes. Hopefully, if you beat the game.
Yes.
Anyways, there's this lady named Shala. Scala? I don't know how you say it.
Sure. Go with that.
In 1200 BC in Chrono Trigger,
mm-hmm.
who gets sucked in with Lavos at some point? I don't even remember.
Something like that.
Okay, anyways, at some point in the darkness beyond time, Lavos and Scala are melding into one entity. Okay. In Chrono Cross, you don't know about Scala. I mean, people talk about her, and they talk about Lavos, but you've never seen them. You've never been interacted with them.
Is there a journal in Chrono Cross? Like, sometimes these role-playing games,
not much. There's this prophet guy, Balthazar, the prophet from Chrono Trigger. He shows up, and he just explains massive amounts of stuff occasionally.
Okay.
But anyways, you go in, your main story is, hey, there's two timelines, Chrono Cross. You cross timelines because in one you died and one you didn't. And then there's Link's leopard man guy is after you. And there's this lady named Kid, girl named Kid, who's friends with you. Anyways, but what you find out eventually is that 10 years ago, in the one where you... No, not in the one where you drowned. Wait, yes. In the one where you drowned... Wait. I'm so confused. Okay, in one of the plot lines, one of the two worlds... And this is the other thing about the game. I'm going back and forth between worlds. I couldn't, and all you got, you know, characters. I'm like, I don't remember what world I met you in. I just, you look the same. I don't know what I'm supposed to say to you.
Which universe is this?
Exactly. Again, if I wasn't playing my kid, some of that might have gone away. But in one timeline, you're on your fishing trip with your dad 10 years ago. You get injured. He goes into this, he finds his way into Chronopolis, which I'll explain later. And then, only way you get in Chronopolis with this magnetic storm. You don't see any of this. This magnetic storm that let down security, so you get in, and you get into this main room that hooks you up with the main fake computer, which has been, Chronopolis was made in the future, and somehow got sent through a time experiment way back in the past. And in order to counteract the difference it made in time, the Reptites from Chrono Trigger, who died when Lavos came down, their future in a world where Lavos didn't come down got pulled into that one, and they fought each other. And the future people who are living now in the past beat the Reptites from the future, who from the other timeline. This is all off. This is all off screen. Okay, and they subjugate them, and they turn them. They take their organic computer and put in six dragons to make the six elements of the magic you now use. And then they make these fake cubes that dictate how people live in this archipelago that didn't exist in Chrono Trigger, but was made by Chronopolis in order to, I don't remember what. but anyways, and then what happens is because you're crying as a 10-year-old boy and there's a magnetic storm that's caused by Shala hearing you cry for help through time, she calls magnetic storm. The lights go down in this place. You sneak in. You touch the fake computer that's lived through all these things that's dictating how the people live. You then become the arbiter of time, the only one who can get in there. And then your father, because the fake computer doesn't like what you did or needs to find you get you back, or I don't remember, turns your father into your last worst enemy, which was this demon panther that was why you were hurt in the first place. So your father becomes this Lynx guy, and then he's trying to save Fate, and you're trying to kill Fate because the dragon has convinced you that you can help them and you shouldn't be doing Fate. And meanwhile, Lynx has this girl with him called Harl. They find out later is a seventh dragon who's double, who also fell in love with you. And and Kid, who's your friend, is actually a clone of Shala, who has this pen that whenever she's going to die, it sends her back in time. And she used to live with Luca, who's from Chrono Trigger, who you don't know because you don't know these people. And almost all of this is said in giant info dumps. And what you get is you show up in the Dead Sea, you find Chronopolis, you see some ghosts of people, and then you kill the fake computer. Like, oh, wait, why did you do that? Because you just disturb all of time and space. And so my main problem with Chrono Cross is while the plot is highly intricate, you don't actually, you're really not an important player in the plot except at the very end. You're basically the product of vast amounts of Balthazar, this prophet of time, and Shala conning other, there's so many times like, well, Fate was trying to do this, but the dragons actually were trying to do this, and then you did that, and like people just tricking each other like constantly, like, like 10 cons, like, haha, I triple dare, you know, I triple crossed you. but you're basically the last, you're basically the product of this giant event, sequence of events that makes you special so that you can use the Chrono Cross and kill Lavos for good and save Shala. So you get to the end of the game, you've never met Shala. Apparently, this person been hanging out with you is a Shala clone, but you don't know what that means unless you even watch Chrono Trigger, and she's not even that big of a character in Chrono Trigger, I don't think. I mean, she's important, but...
She's important, but yeah, no, there's not a whole lot of screen time.
And then she has a great theme song. You use the Chrono Cross, and you have the good ending. I mean, again, there's alternate endings when you replay it,
which there's alternate endings in Chrono Trigger, too, which I haven't done either.
You do the good Chrono Cross ending, you use the Chrono Cross, Shala comes off, and she's rescued. And then there's blocks of text of her talking to you about how fate kills some people, but we live. And I'm just like, I don't have any emotional connection with any of this. And I think that was my big deal. And is that if I hadn't been playing with the kids, I might have gotten more of the details of the individual. Because like 30 characters you can get.
That's an insanely huge party that you.
Well, you can only have three at a time.
Well, yeah, obviously, but I mean, that's even more than Final Fantasy VI had, like 12.
Well, I've played Suikoden has 100.
Really?
Yeah, you get this tower, and they all have little roles in it, and you don't have the. A lot of them are just to make populate your tower.
Okay.
So kind of cool.
So they're not necessarily all that important.
No, and I'm not sure. In Crossway, it was fun to get new people and whatever. They all have little side stories and whatever, and I suppose that would add some to it. So I think there's a lot of complexity that if you dig deep, you can really enjoy. But it really felt like I was just skimming on the surface of something I didn't understand. I mean, they do this download after I killed the fate computer. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. And I'm reading it to my kids. I'm like, guys, I don't know. I really don't know. And then later on, they have no download. And like, they almost explained what happened like
in
the previous download. I'm like, oh, okay, that makes a little more sense. Except there's 7 dragons. I just learned that the dragons were even part of this organic computer it's like seeing the very, very tip of the iceberg. And it was. To me, I guess if you like just complication, it's interesting from an intellectual point of view, but it's really not engaging on a personal level, I didn't feel, in the way I played it.
Well, let me ask you this, and then we'll move on.
Yeah,
to
that was a long... I had to do my spiel for Tim. He was dying over here.
That was really good. It's just amazing. But all that aside, the stuff in the game you did get to explore, was it interesting?
Yeah, it was. No, the locales are fascinating. Once you got used to having so many people in the choices, it was quite an enjoyable game. When you got used to the different fighting style, the more you play style-wise, the more you broke away from Chrono Trigger and got used to how it did its own thing, it was a neat game. I liked it. If I had more time and just a certain amount of time, I'd probably go through and try to do some of the stuff I did on the Game Plus. Mm-hmm. No, it was an entertaining game. It's just weird because on one hand, play-wise, you had to break away from a lot of conventions of Chrono Trigger. But on the other hand, to really understand half the importance of the plot, you really need a deep knowledge of Chrono Trigger. Mm. So it's just kind of, it's a weird thing to request, I think, of a person.
That is strange. It's interesting to imagine retirement homes in the future and all the video gaming that'll be going on with, you know, all of us millennials and Generation Xers that didn't like, oh, I've been meaning to play this game for 50 years.
Now, I will say, in defense of the plot, I did read the person who did the plotting for Xenogears, and I think it's the same person or same team, said Xenogears was kind of like episode 5 of 6. And so they kind of crank, you know, it's like the very end of a... era, but you didn't, because of the video game, you didn't get the other eras. And I think Chrono Cross is just set up sort of that way, that
they made a huge amount of World Bible stuff for it, and then you got a sliver of it.
You got to do a journey that got you to connect to all of it, but you weren't actually important except the very last stage of it.
Yeah.
Which there's something too, but it was not at all what I was expecting, and it's really complicated.
Interesting.
Yeah. So anyways, so I think you have one more game if we have time.
Well, yeah, we got a little bit of time. Interesting contrast to the Chrono Trigger conundrum. Like I said, it took me 3 years.
Yeah.
I recently played Kingdom Hearts 3D Dream Drop Distance. That's, get it, 3D.
Dun, dun, dun.
That took me like about, 2 weeks. Which is not to say that the game is short per se. And actually, there's still an optional boss I haven't fought yet or finished yet. But Kingdom Hearts is I'm a huge, big, longtime fan of it.
Yeah, what do we call a fan of Kingdom Hearts? Do they have a nice name?
I don't know that they do, actually. No, I don't think there's...
You just heart the game.
Yeah, pretty much. But the other thing is, it is a little easier to do in chunks, like as opposed to like a role-playing game where like you don't know where you're going to wind up. It's like, well, you've got these Disney worlds that you know you're going to visit. So, you know, it's easier to like, okay, I'll stop here or whatever. But Dream Drop Distance is on the 3DS, which I have to thank Aaron Murray for lending me. That is my sister's boyfriend's brother, who I don't know that I've even met in person, but he was kind enough to lend me his 3DS so I could finally play this thing. Because it's been out for like 4 years, and they're getting ready to do... Tricky thing about the Kingdom Hearts franchise is that they've spread... They've put
games
out...
everything.
Well, they put games out on like... 6 different systems.
Okay.
So unless you're a real gamer and already own all these things, it's really hard to play some of these. Now, they've done some HD versions, yeah, and they've compiled some of these for, like, they did like 2 PS3 compilations. Okay. But if you want to be, and actually, there's another one coming out in December. But if, like I said, this game's been out for 4 years. If you want to interact with the Phantom at all, it's hard not to hear about certain things that happen. And there is this ongoing storyline with all these things. But anyway, so I finally played it. There is a lot to enjoy about it. I would say it might be my third or fourth favorite in the series. The basic concept, if you don't know Kingdom Hearts, you know, the main character, Sora, wields this thing called a Keyblade. He goes around and helps protect Disney worlds from various cartoonish monsters.
Heartless, Norm. Well.
Well, heartless. It depends on the game.
Yeah, that's true.
It's usually heartless. That's the most common. The premise at the start of this one is that they realize that one, the main baddie of the series, who is indirectly responsible for all the final bosses of the series, is basically about to be revived for Kingdom Hearts 3, coming out soon, hopefully. And so because Sora and his best friend Riku are essentially self-taught Keyblade wielders, they wanted to make sure they're ready, they're trained, that they have the mark of mastery as to be a true Keyblade master or whatever. And so they actually go out to, in the very first game, there's a bunch of worlds that had fallen to darkness that are apparently, some of them, most of them you rescued by the end of the game. A couple of them, some of them are still asleep. So the goal at least is to go and rescue those few remaining worlds and in the process kind of earn your stripes as it is. Even though you've already technically saved the world a couple of times, the universe a couple times. Yeah, you still might not be good enough.
You're chosen, but you're not that.
It's pretty evident from the start that even after that setup, well, they tell the setup in flashbacks, which I was like, really? When I first started the game, I was like, wait, what is going on? It would have been easier if they had just, but by the end of the first world, you know at least, if you hadn't read the back cover, you know at least what's going on.
The back cover.
But at the same time, it's pretty evident at first that something is still not going quite according to plan, and you slowly get pieces of that toward the end. And this game was kind of divisive among a lot of Kingdom Hearts fans, I think, because of the ending. And I won't go into quite as... this is slightly spoilery. And it was a huge shock to me because this is something I'd heard before. But like the end basically involves the main series of bad guys, Xehanort, who had apparently gone into the past and brought together 13 versions of himself as to be his own super evil team.
A Doofenshmirtz plan.
And apparently there's very strict rules for the time travel, though, so to keep him from abusing it too much, so you're able to foil this massive thing by the end. But again, lots of setup for Kingdom Hearts 3 in this thing, which in some ways, like, well, it sounds like it's a major tease. But at the same time, which it sort of is, but at the same time, when the game came out, it also sort of commemorated the 10th anniversary of Kingdom Hearts.
Okay.
And it was actually kind of cool in that you felt like, because Kingdom Hearts 2 came out in 2006, and the numbered titles are kind of the main.
Yeah.
Everyone's been waiting for Kingdom Hearts 3 for a long time. And a lot of these, the handhelds they've been doing in meantime, a lot of people view as spinoff, even though they're not. They have some very important elements to the ongoing plot. But this, it was really fun to see them kind of incorporate a lot of these ideas and title together. There were some scenes you've been waiting for a long time to finally see, like two people, what would happen if these two characters met? And they met in this game, and it was really cool. And so there's a lot of fan-pleasing moments like that. Again, like I said, people complain about the ending because it's ridiculous, but Kingdom Hearts is kind of known for its crazy, yours Chrono Cross story plotline sounded kind of convoluted. Kingdom Hearts can be too, but it's not quite as much. You still feel more involved in the overall process. One thing I had forgotten to tie into Kingdom Hearts from our Chosen One discussion is that some people actually don't like, because in the very first game, Sora is sort of like set up as if he's the only Keyblade wielder, like the Keyblade chose him. And then they did a prequel game, Birth by Sleep, which I talked about the podcast a while back, where they show that there are a lot more and that there's actually this passing on ceremony. And some people didn't like that some people thought it made Sora feel like he was less special.
Yeah.
Like he wasn't. So, again, example. And then other people like, but I like that they kind of showed a deeper history here. Yeah. So, again, there's a backlash against Chosen One stuff that some people still like it, some people don't. Like I said, overall, I enjoyed the game. The Disney worlds were mostly pretty. Something interesting they did in this one is probably the fewest number of worlds in the Kingdom Hearts game. For a game that had all new worlds. Yeah. Sometimes you get a couple of the games, they just had repeat worlds. But all of them were new in this one, the fewest number, but they made each one huge.
Okay.
Like, cool. A lot of the maps were, like, not labyrinth in terms of, like, you had to follow a lot of paths, but just in terms of, like, man, there's a lot to navigate in this thing. My favorite one, probably, and it wasn't even all that tied into the greater story, but the Fantasia world was awesome.
Ooh, that sounds cool.
Yeah, because here's the interesting thing about this game. Sora and Riku, you play as both of them at different times, but because they're in dream worlds, they both fall asleep. Like, you actually have a dream gauge. Like, after a certain period of time, the character you're playing at will fall asleep, and then you start playing as the other character.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. Birth by Sleep, you played as multiple characters too, but you could choose to play, like, just all of one's character storyline and then go to another character storyline. But this one kind of forced you to jump back and forth. But anyway, so Sora and Riku had completely different areas that they explored in the Fantasia world. And Riku's was all the Nutcracker with all the Nutcracker sequences from Fantasia. And then Sora's was, I can't remember the name of the pieces now. But in Fantasia, it's the one with all the Greek mythology stuff.
Yeah.
So you, like, at first he's up in the clouds, and then there's an area with all the colored trees and things like that. And it's just really cool to explore. For one, just the area, then two, because they took out most of the sound. You know, usually whenever you're fighting stuff, you go, they took out most of the sound effects in Fantasia except for the music.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That one makes sense.
Yeah, it made total sense, but it made it really fun to explore. So the bad guys weren't my favorites, the enemies. They were called Dream Eaters. Birth by Sleep had Unversed. Kingdom Hearts 2 had Nobody's. Heartless are usually kind of the default if you don't have one of these special ones. The Dream Eaters were, like, I didn't care for them as much because they're basically like animals, but like with tie-dye colors.
Okay.
It's like not nearly as intimidating in my sense, but I guess it kind of goes with the fanciful dream motif. But
interesting.
So anyway, they're quick spin on all that. All
right. So
that's more gaming stuff than we've talked about in quite a while.
Yeah. Well, we waited a while and we've both actually played something. So, please, if you play Chrono Cross and you want to correct my my explanation, go for it or add to it. But yeah, I
guess. Provide a Cliff Notes version, I suppose.
My thesis on Chrono Cross. So,
at some point, I loved your hearing you talk rant about all that, because at some point, I've always wanted to do like a mythology of Kingdom Hearts.
I know you said that it's quite complicated.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you can easily skim the surface and just get by, but if you, like, even the time travel things, people are like, why do you have to bring time travel? It's like, well, you know, the ability to stop time has been one of your magic spells since the first game.
Yeah.
So the weird thing about Kingdom Hearts is they seem to kind of retcon a lot of stuff in, but at the same time, if you look, it's like, well, but that's sort of kind of...
At least doesn't seem outside the universe they've created.
Yes.
Even they retcon it constantly.
It's not unlike Lost in that a lot of times what they tell you is going on at the beginning of a game is not what is actually going on.
By that game or the next game.
Yes, exactly.
That whole last game, you weren't doing that. So, okay, awesome. Well, I guess we should probably wrap this up.
Yeah, probably. What? See that cloud over there? It kind of looks like a buffalo. Looks like it's coming this way awfully fast.
Weird. You think it's friendly?
Hopefully. Huh? I could have swore I just saw some kid hang glide off of it, but
We've seen weirder things.
We've seen weirder things, but it probably means it's time for us to go.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, I guess we'll do...
We should give our contact info.
Exactly. So you can always see us at derailtrainsofthought.blogspot.com. I know most of you probably go to the iTunes or Stitcher or YouTube to watch it, but if you want to leave us a nice comment, come to our blog.
And let us know what we got wrong.
And please leave comments reviews on iTunes. That would be very helpful.
That would be awesome.
And tell your friends, because most of the people who've listened to it have heard it from other people who said, hey, this is worth listening to.
Yep. We're one of those weird specialty things that, like, you don't know that you want to listen to us until you start listening to us.
Where were you all my life? Well, we were on iTunes. So you can email us at derailtrains@gmail.com. Yeah. I don't know. Do you ever check the email?
It's been a little while.
Okay. So my soundtrack, I had to go with some Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, which we've not done that game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Link is pretty much your chosen hero sort of guy.
He kind of keeps fighting the same fight over and over again throughout different...
That's how it works.
Kind of like the Avatar, actually, in some ways.
Yeah. So,
fan theory. Link is actually the Avatar of Hyrule.
Doom, doom, doom. That'd be kind of awesome. Okay, anyways, the title of this remix is The Goddess Gets Groovy Tonight. it's remixed by Garrett Williamson and Sir Jordanius, who was also responsible for Nice Legs last time.
Did he give birth to Nice Legs?
Yes, he does. Okay. I guess so. It's very, he's a weird creature.
Sorry, I couldn't love that one.
I knew as soon as I said it, something it wasn't going to go well. but anyways, it's a funky little song, and I hope you enjoy.
Awesome.
And I guess we'll see you later.
All right. Until next time, this is Tim.
This is Nick.
Bye-bye.